So my name's Hannah. I'm an alcoholic. I'm your 10-minute speaker, and then I will release you guys for 10 minutes. So my name's Hannah. I'm an alcoholic. I grew up in a family of alcoholics. My dad was an alcoholic. His dad is an alcoholic. And I like how the book puts it. It says that we have a disease, and then it breaks it down and says dis-ease. And I really identify with that. Some people say that, you know, they were born alcoholic, and some people don't identify with that, but I do. I always remember feeling not enough. I was always trying to overcompensate. I would call it today doing the most. I was always doing the most. I was always trying to be the best at something or the funniest. I had a really pretty smart sister that I couldn't live up to, so I just used rebellion and kind of like shock value as my doing the most and trying to be known as something, you know? So I didn't pick up a drink until I want to say I was 17 years old, and that first drink wasn't, I didn't get drunk, I don't think, that night, but I did breathe for the first time. Ryan talks about, and he explains it so well, just, you know, I was finally okay with who I was. Or I like to say I didn't care anymore. I didn't care if I was enough. I didn't care if I was the most. I didn't care. The obsession started right there. I don't think I got drunk that first time, but very shortly after I did. And people that used to drink with me know that I drank like an alcoholic pretty much from day one. I, you know, was the person that people were like, oh, gosh, here she goes, you know. I drank and I did it pretty well. I got into outside issues really early on, just to continue the party. It wasn't just the alcohol that I loved, but it was everything about that lifestyle. I wanted to stay up. I wanted it to go for days. And I'm really grateful for outside issues because it brought me to my bottom pretty quickly. I had probably been drinking alcoholically maybe 2 years before I got in trouble. I got my first DUI when I was 19 years old. It didn't slow me down at all. Like, it wasn't even a thought. Like, oh, maybe I should kind of slow down on drinking. It was more, awesome, I don't have to drive anymore. Perfect. You know? And that should have maybe, you know, been an identifier, but also a little part of my story is I was also always dubbed as just like my dad, and he was an alcoholic, but he was practicing this program for most of my life. He relapsed after a long-term sobriety, and I knew I was an alcoholic, right? I knew that this was going to be my life. So I identified really early. I just didn't care. And I was like, I'm going to get in all I can get in before I have to do something about it, you know? Make sure you tell me five so I can get the solution. You know, I went to rehab when I was 21 years old, and I was already terrified. I had done enough damage. I had put my family in harm's way. They, you know, are very loving and supportive, and their solution was, you can't stay with us anymore. You know, you've burned your bridges here. So I really wasn't the person that was dragged into rehab. I was kind of really looking for a solution. I had identified myself as an alcoholic. I just was, I guess, finally, like, tapped out. You know, I was like, okay, this is getting kind of scary, and that's kind of weird for me to be scared, so I probably should do something about this. I went into rehab, and it was a faith-based recovery home, and it did a lot of good, and it did a lot of bad. You know, I wanted and had the desire to stay sober, so in that cage, I did stay sober. When I say I did some bad, is it really kind of incubated my ego. I was able to say, use God and say that, okay, you know, I went through my mess for a reason, so now I can go back and, like, save the world, you know? I would, you know, they would choose me to pray. And, you know, it just, like I said, incubated my ego. And I started working for that program, and I started kind of living this lie that religion did to me. I don't want to say, like, this is everybody's story, but it just really told me, pretend. Pretend you're doing well. Just, you know, look good. And so I was like, okay, like, so I'd go home on, like, my little breaks, and I would drink, and then I'd come back and I would pray and be behind the pulpit again. And I was able to use that kind of as a mask. So when I started working for that program, you know, inevitably I relapsed, and it was a pretty nasty bottom. I didn't know I was capable of some of the things I was doing. And I was finally really scared, because if this God that I found, because I had found a relationship with my higher power, I just hadn't done the second step. I didn't truly believe that he could restore me to sanity. Clearly, I didn't. So I came in here really scared, not believing it was going to work. But I just sat in the meetings. No, that's a lie. If anyone was here, they know I didn't just sit in the meeting. I was still preaching. I was so obnoxiously religious, and just so judgmental. But what I really was terrified. I was so scared. Like, I was going to be that exception that couldn't stay sober. Like, my God couldn't even keep me sober, you know? Something that stuck out really early was open-minded. And I remember praying a prayer, like, God, these people obviously have something I don't. Like, clearly, you know, like, you're going to have to help me be willing to become open-minded, because I was so closed-minded. It was all fear-based, you know, and I think I had a spiritual awakening. I remember, you know, sitting at a meeting and arguing with this guy, and it was as if I was seeing myself outside. And for the first time, like, I just felt like God was just like, shut up, girl. Shut your mouth. Stop talking. And I was like, oh. So I tried to, like, listen, I want to say, for a couple weeks. And just listening instead of talking, I heard stuff. I heard the solution. I heard that there was people that were, and I stopped caring about your program and started caring about mine, you know? And then God took me on this crazy journey of, like, putting into action my open-mindedness. I met, you know, I don't recommend this for everybody, but I met my husband really early on in recovery, and he was an atheist. But he was such a good guy. Like, I was like, no, this can't be. Like a fly drawn to the light. And, you know, we got married really early on in recovery, but it was important for me. It was a journey that I learned, you know. Anyways, it was just, God just took me on this crazy journey. And I got about 2 years into recovery, and I had kind of dabbled in sponsorship. And I kind of done the pro, you know, I would like to say, but really I was just going to meetings, and I was just not drinking, and I was super dry. And there was a couple nights that Randy, my atheist husband, prayed over me because I was about to go have a drink, you know, and I would tell him, like, you don't want to see me drink. And he was like, okay, God, please don't let her drink, you know. And then I remember throwing our wedding album over, like, my apartment building, and everyone's heard that story. But it was important for me. It was a spiritual awakening for me, and I finally picked up the phone, and I called who God had been telling me to be my sponsor from. We got married on the same day. It was weird. Anyways, you know, God set it up, and I started my first journey in recovery 2 years sober, and I don't recommend it for people, but it's when my recovery actually started happening. So I started doing step work, and that first year was crazy. And then the second year was crazy. You know, God just took me on such a journey, and I love my sponsor's husband always talks about, don't kill yourself in the first 5 years because you won't know who you're killing. And I kind of, like, really irritated me, because I was like, I fucking know who I am. Excuse my language. I'm trying not to cuss. I know who I am. What are you talking about, you know? And then 5 years happened, and even honestly 6 for me, and it makes sense, right, because I didn't start recovery really until later on. Like, I finally feel like I know who I am, or I'm getting to know who I am, and I'm discovering and discarding and, you know, all this jazz, and it's been amazing. And I get to not be black and white anymore. I get to live in this gray world that is the most beautiful thing that's ever happened to me. You know, I always want to say, you know, the steps, this book that, you know, changed my life. live in like that triangle today of recovery and service and unity. And that's probably the first, you know, this last year has probably been the first time I've done that. And I really feel like balanced, you know, I see the benefit and the true value of that. You know, I'm not so much this, and I'm not so much that. Like, I'm just a little bit of, you know, they say if you give everything just like, if you're doing things too well, if you're doing one thing too well, then you're not doing the other thing good enough, you know? And I'm kind of just like 15%ing it to every little, all of my little, you know, service. I have a family. It's really easy for me to say like, oh, I got to focus on that. And I get into isolation all the time. But I want to say in the last year, I know when I'm off balance and I really can kind of tweak my teeter totter and it feels good. What am I at? Am I over 10 already? You're at 10. My husband can tell me that, right? Anyways, I just love this program. I love my God, but I love what this program has done to my relationship with this God. I feel like it's very authentic today. I feel like it's genuine and it's real. And I'm in a world of gray, and anyone that knows me knows I'm so black and white, and that's huge today. I heard a speaker say, you know, if you want to know if you're spiritually growing, ask yourself, are you easier to be around? And I'm a lot easier to be around today than I was 6 years ago. And God has given me AA to do that. It's a program for life learning, not just not drinking. I get to learn how to be, to match my insides to my outsides. And I'm really, truly grateful for this program, and I'm grateful for all of you. Couldn't do it without you. So I'm going to just with you guys here to introduce someone that's been super special in my life, Catherine S. Okay. Hi, I'm Catherine. I'm an alcoholic. Okay, I'll have to. Well, my sobriety date is April 3rd, 1995. And, you know, I was talking to somebody before the meeting, and I was telling them, I can't believe that who I am today is who I am today. You know, that girl that walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous 22 years ago is nowhere close to who I am today. I don't even recognize that girl anymore. I weighed 22 pounds. No, I did not. I lied. Okay, I'm going to try to keep it honest. I weighed 95 pounds on a good day, and I did. I weighed 95 pounds. My hair was falling out, and I was gaunt, and I was completely insane. And that's how I arrived at the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for me to sit here today, to be asked to come and participate in my own sobriety by carrying a message of hope, it's not what I thought 22 years ago that I would be doing today. My life today is nothing what I thought I could have at all. So I'll give you a couple of warnings. First of all, I'm going to drink a lot of water because I can't seem to breathe in this air. And with the fire, my throat's really sore. So I'm just going to let you know that right away. And then second of all, I went down to Bakersfield a few years ago, and that's when I discovered I have hot flashes. And I had gone down there to be a speaker, and it was kind of like this. And for some strange reason in California, I'm deciding to wear a turtleneck. And so I have this turtleneck on, and I get up to the stage, and I'm completely, like, burning out. My face is red, and I'm trying to speak, and I have this little index card, thank goodness. And I'm fanning myself. And that's how I discovered hot flashes for me. The next day I get up and my husband's in his office, and he called me in there and he said, look here. And on the screen was all these beautiful fans. And he said, pick out your fans. And he bought me fans so that I didn't have to have hot flashes. So I'm also going to warn you, I'm doing this a lot tonight because I can't stand it. So, you know, a lot about Alcoholics Anonymous has changed my life, but I think the biggest thing for me, other than giving me a person that I can respect today, a person that I can actually admire, a person that I can have fun with,
you know, a person that I actually have a relationship with myself today. It also gave me the freedom, that freedom that it talks about in the third step, freedom from bondage of self. And I had a lot of bondage. Going back into my history a little bit, I was born, I don't know if I was born an alcoholic, but I certainly was born with a brain of an alcoholic. My brain didn't function like the rest of the world. I didn't know what was wrong with it. My brain actually didn't perceive the world the same way the rest of my family did. I kind of felt like I was an alien in my own family. I have an older sister and a younger sister, and I'm a middle child. I don't blame any of my problems on being a middle child. I also don't today blame my problems on my family either, like I used to. But for some reason, when I was born, I came out of the chute afraid. Afraid of everybody, afraid of everything, and mostly afraid of myself. I was afraid I wasn't going to fit in. I was afraid I wasn't going to be pretty enough. I was afraid I wasn't going to be smart enough. And I was actually very afraid I wasn't going to be thin enough. And that was a big deal for me. And that's kind of how I started off my life. And that started way soon. And I don't know where it came from. I came from a really great family who didn't instill those thoughts into me. They didn't try to make me try to look a certain way. They didn't try to do these things. But my perception of what was going on was really screwed up. And my father was military, and we moved around a lot. And I grew up basically over in Germany. I lived there from right after kindergarten, so first grade, we moved over there, and I stayed there until I returned to the States between sixth and seventh grade. I was like 11 years old. And so when we moved over there, my mom decided that she thought we should really become like Germans, you know, live on the economy and really embrace the culture. And all of the furniture in our house was German. We shopped on the German economy. I kind of was made to try to have friends that were German. I didn't even speak the language. And so I don't know what she was thinking, but that's kind of what I did. And I didn't feel like I fit in. And when we came back to the United States, at the age of 11, I was already fearful. I already felt like I didn't fit in. And we come back to what I considered a new culture, because I had never really lived in the States, but yet I was an American, so everybody just kind of threw me in there and thought I should just assimilate into this American school, American way of life, American way of thinking, which was totally different than the Germans. And so that was difficult. I didn't realize that until I got sober what part of my problem was. I had never had a hamburger at McDonald's. They didn't have them back then. You know, we didn't eat fast food. And the kids thought I was weird. They're like, what? You've never had a hamburger at McDonald's? You've never heard of that? And I'm like, no. And they just thought I was weird. So I already felt weird. And then top it off with, you know, not knowing hamburgers from McDonald's. That just sealed the deal for them, you know. And I felt very weird. So it just kind of verified that I was a weird person, at least in my head. And so when I got to meet this group of kids who were not the kind of kids that my family really wanted me to try to meet, they introduced me to my first drink of alcohol. And it's not like I'd never been exposed to alcohol. My father drank. You know, it's not my job to say whether he was an alcoholic or not or a functioning alcoholic. I just know that a lot of his and my connection was because of the drinking. I would be the one at a very young age to prepare his drink for him. I knew if I wanted to hang out with my dad, if I went and got his beer and cracked it open and he'd let me have the first drink, you know, and delivering it to him, he was okay with that so long as I'd get his beer for him. But, you know, he was very functional. There was no violence in the house. He never lost a job. Our family stayed together. I didn't see a representation of any kind of what we consider alcoholism, you know, in the house. But it doesn't necessarily mean that alcohol was not in my house and was a pretty prominent member of my household. So for when a child introduces Jack Daniels to me, I'm right on board because that was my dad's drink. And I thought, yeah, I could do that. And these are what these kids are doing. And that first drink was exactly what Hannah described. I went, oh, and that feeling of relief. And it talks about it in the book. I can so relate to the part of the book where it talks about that ease and comfort. You know, the drink gave me that ease and comfort that I had never had in my entire life. And I say entire life, I'm 11. So it's not like it's been a long entire lifespan of all this unease and discomfort. But that's how I kind of felt by the age of 11, that it had been a whole lifetime of dis-ease and uncomfort. And the alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. it gave me that ability to feel like I was smart and to feel like I could fit in and to be okay with the idea that I'd never had a McDonald's hamburger. And it gave me the ability to have that liquid courage to go out there and do in life what I felt like I was never capable of doing on my own. It gave me the ability to go out there and be a pom-pom girl, you know, because I always thought they were pretty cool girls at the school. I wanted to be a pom-pom girl. And I went out and tried out and became a pom-pom girl. In high school, I decided I wanted to be a majorette, and I'd never twirled a baton in my life, but, you know, put a little alcohol in me, I think I'm like the best majorette this history has ever seen. I'm twirling fire at the games, you know. You know, they say twirl fire. I'm like, okay, but I don't even know how to twirl a baton, but I can do that. You know, alcohol gave me that ability to all of a sudden become somebody that I'm actually not. And but I got through high school. I got through college drinking. But I'll tell you what, I went on my first spiritual quest when I was in the 11th grade. And I felt like I needed to do something different with my life. I never connected up, though, that it had anything to do with alcohol. But I could already start seeing where my behavior, some of those lines that I said in my head I would never cross, I started to kind of cross when I was in high school. And these kids over at the church looked like pretty good kids. And I thought, well, you know what, by osmosis, they'll just kind of rub off on me. If I show up and do the youth group and behave like them, I'm going to be a better person. It's going to make me an okay person, and I'll try to fit in again. And so I did that, but you know what, I don't know, for some reason, they didn't really kind of take to me, because I think I was still drinking and doing the side dishes and still kind of acting out the way I was acting out, and so I never connected there either, but I did go off on this spiritual quest, and I thought God was going to be able to fix me and my behavior problems. Not my drinking problem, my behavior problem is what I thought. And that worked enough that I still kept going on it, and then I actually went to a Christian college. And I thought, you know what, I'll go there. And you know what I found out at Christian college for me was that's where the people drink. You know, some of my best drinking buddies were the ones that I found in my Christian college. And we went there and I partied so hard, but I partied away all my friends. You know, they couldn't even handle me. And by the end, I had no real friends in my class and mates anymore. I was able to graduate. I did graduate. And for me, what I used to do was because I didn't put down the drink and I was losing friends, I was very easy to make friends. I just didn't know how to keep them. You know, my behavior was what they talk about in the book as well. I could so relate to this part. It says, and I think it's in Dr. Paul O's story, actually, where it talks about while I'm judging myself by my good intentions, the world is judging me by my actions. And I couldn't seem to get people to understand, you know, I didn't mean to do that. You know, I've got this great intention. This is what I intended to do. I'm sorry if you can't handle that this is what I actually did. And for some reason, I was able to blame them for the problems and the mistakes and the chaos that I was craving through everybody's life. And I would turn it back off on them. Excuse me. So needless to say, that didn't make for a good friendship, for long-term friendships at least. And so by the time I was done with college, I didn't have any friends left either. And actually, by the time I was done with college, I barely had family members left in my life. My mom and dad were always there for me, but those two sisters that I talked about, they started distancing themselves pretty much. And I can remember the only time I would call my younger sister when she was in college, and I was just out of college, and I would call her, and the only time I would call her would be like at 2 o'clock in the morning drunk and tell her all of my woes. And then, you know, that self-pity party we go into, she was the unfortunate hostage I would take at 2 a.m. And she would get to hear that. And then I couldn't understand why she didn't want to just hang out with me, you know. You know, I'm a pretty great gal. I've got all these great intentions. And so that just kind of kept going. And so what I would do is I would then become a workaholic, because then I could prove myself. I could become that number one person that was out there being the best at my work. I did it through college when I started losing all my friends. I became the member of every single committee on campus, including the karate club. And I didn't even know karate. But they said, would you like to be the secretary for the karate club? I'm like, sure, why not? Because it gave me one more thing to do. Because I didn't have any friends. You know, I had pretty much excluded everybody out of my life so that I could drink. And the only way people would hang out with me, I mean, this is really sad, the only way people would hang out with me is I would be willing to serve them on some committee. And that's where I felt like I had my friends. So I kept myself busy that way, and I did the same thing when I went off to work. And I became this really career-oriented type of person. And I was like, you know, I'm going to be the best there as well. I don't know what I want to do, but now that I've graduated, I want to get a briefcase. I'm going to get a job that's going to allow me to have my own office so I can be someone. And I'm going to go off to this job, whatever it is, and be the best at it. And that's kind of what I did. And I got hooked up into the mortgage financing industry, and I did that, and I made friends again. And all the while, you've got to remember, I'm military. We've been moving. And I didn't mind the moving. You know, it didn't dawn on me until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody said, that must have been really hard on you to move all the time. And for me, you know, that was the first time I thought about it. A lot of military kids do have a problem doing that, but I didn't, because every time we would move, my thought would be, oh, good. Now I can go somewhere else and start over. I'll have another chance to prove myself. And then we would move to this new town, and like I said, I could make friends. You know, I had no problem doing that. I would make my friends, and not very long afterwards, off they'd go. And here I was by myself again, and my dad would say, well, it's time to move. And I'd say, good. You know, and that's kind of how I led my life, and I did that throughout my adulthood, too. Geographics was great for me. In fact, I married a military man, so I could do that. You know, I just kept moving around, trying at new places, because I was sure it was the people and the place that was the problem, not me. But there I went with me, and all the problems would materialize again. You know, this guy was my first husband. This is a great alcoholic story, thinking. He asked me out. I met this guy. He was at a bar. Well, I called them dance clubs. You know, it was like 10 years sober before I realized I hung out in bars. You know, I didn't go hang out in bars. I was not a bar lady, you know. I was not a bar lady. I was like, what's wrong with you people? I went to dance clubs, jazz clubs, piano bars, you know. I was prim and proper. What's wrong with you? I don't go to bars. Okay, so today I went to this bar. And I've realized enough now why I was there. I was there to find the alcohol and to find the guys, right? So that's where I went. I went off to the bar, and this guy asked me to dance, and I was like, okay. So I went and danced with him, and then he just kept hanging out, and I didn't even like him. And then after, but he kept asking me to dance, and more importantly, he kept buying me drinks. But I did notice he wasn't drinking, but he kept buying me drinks. And then after we closed the place out, because that's what you do. You know, I don't know about you guys, but I still kind of do that in AA. I'm like talking afterwards at events, they're closing off the lights, and they're saying, leave, leave. And I'm like, oh, okay. You know, so I close places out. That's still old behavior for me. But I would close the place out. So he was talking me out in the parking lot, and it was after I sang the national anthem, because for some reason when I get drunk, I would like to go out to the parking lot and sing the national anthem. And I think that came from my college years, because I used to sing the national anthem for the football team. So anyway, so yeah, so that poor people had to listen to that. And you know, this man must have been really crazy, because he actually waited till I was done to sing the national anthem so he could get my phone number. I was not interested. I was like, no. And my sister's like, no, give it to him. He seems like a nice enough guy. I'm like, okay. So I give him my phone number. He calls me up. And we're talking on the phone, and he tells me that, you know, he doesn't drink. Apparently, his family had problems with alcohol, his father and everybody. So he's like, I don't want to get near him. What was he doing with me? Seriously, think about this. Here's a girl out in the parking lot drunk singing the national anthem, and he has an issue about alcohol, so he's not going to drink, but I'll hook up with some girl that's an alcoholic. It doesn't make any sense to me. But he says, would you like to go out? And I said, well, I don't know. And he said, yeah. He goes, well, he goes, I'll drive. I know you're going to want to drink. Designate a driver. I was like, yeah, I'll go out with you. That sounds good to me. Somehow that led into, sure, I'll marry you. And, you know, that's kind of how I live my life. I'm not sure why I married him, but I can tell you, through that marriage, I was still participating in my disease. We had a child. And that's the best thing that happened from that marriage. You know, and I didn't learn my lessons, unfortunately. But there are some lessons I know today. But at the time, I didn't learn my lessons through that first marriage. And I kept drinking, and I kept getting worse, and we ended up getting divorced. I ended up losing my job. because I, like I said, I was wanting to do the best, so I ended up making my way into Denver, Colorado, and I became this really top-notch woman with finances, and I was on the 17th floor, and I had my office with the couch in there, and my briefcase, and my suit, as crazy as a loon, you know, but I looked good, and I always wanted to make sure I looked good. You know, I wore that mask really well. And so I had done that. I had gotten the husband. I had gotten the house. I had gotten the job that I wanted. I had done everything that I set out to do. So why was I so miserable? Why was I so empty inside? I was even weighing the right weight. I weighed 95 pounds. Still wanting to lose more, but, you know, I could settle for 95. You know, you would think in my head that I would be satisfied, but I was never satisfied either, and it was never enough. And by this time, I'm like 29 years old, no, 28, because it was right before my divorce, so I was like 28 years old, and I have this little boy who's two at that time, 2 years old, and I can remember literally crying because my life wasn't anything what I wanted it to be, but yet I had set it up exactly the way I thought it should have looked. And I was so miserable inside. And I can literally remember, well, we get divorced. Let me tell you this part first. We get divorced. I finally leave him. And we lose the house. I lose my job. I lose my self-respect. It's all gone at this point. I'm doing things, you know, those little lines that I said, those kind of those little things that I started to cross a little bit earlier. By this time, I'm 29. I'm full force, full blown into this disease, and I have crossed almost every single one of those lines that I said I would never, ever cross. And I was so miserable that I can remember sitting in my apartment by myself in the pull-out bed so that my son could have the room. And it was late at night, and I would watch Letterman. I'd go out, and at this point, one of the lines that I had crossed, because I said I would never drink by myself, that was one of those no-nos. You know, for me, you don't drink in the morning, otherwise you might have a problem. So I always drank till 4 a.m., white-knuckled it till noon. So that meant I didn't have an alcohol problem. And you didn't drink and drive, which I didn't drink and drive. I drank before I got in the car. I drank after I got out of the car, but I never drank while I was in the car. So obviously I didn't drink and drive. So, you know, I kept doing that. And you didn't drink by yourself. Only people, really sad alcoholic people, drink in bars, which obviously I didn't. And you didn't drink in bars by yourself as a woman, especially. Otherwise, that's just really sad. And so I ended up drinking at home by myself in a pull-out couch watching David Letterman. And I can remember I was so done with life, and there was a little bit of Jack Daniels left in the bottle. And I can literally remember listening to David Letterman in the background drinking this alcohol, crying because I didn't want to drink it. But I knew I had to. And I'm not sure at that time why I didn't recognize that maybe I had a little bit of a problem with alcohol. But my brain never crossed over to that idea that I had a problem with drinking, that alcohol had even become a problem in my life. I just drank it, crying, miserable on the inside. And I couldn't admit that I had actually lost my job. I was more in the idea of that they let me go. I wasn't sure why. I didn't understand completely that they had fired me, but in my mind, I had said they let me go. So now I have no job, no husband, no home, and completely insane, and in this little apartment in Denver by myself. And the only person left in my life was my mother. And I can remember her calling and trying to talk me into coming back to Visalia so that she could help me. And I can remember in my head thinking, what do I need help with? You know, that's how far gone out of reality. They also talk about that part in the book where it says full flight from reality. That was me. Here's this little scared 95-pound girl with nothing left in her life, as sad as I was, not drinking but not wanting to drink, and crying because I had to drink, not understanding that I had to drink, and that's why I was crying. And my mother, the only person left in my life, saying, come here, let me help take care of you. And I'm saying, no, everything's fine. I'm fine. I'm going to do fine. I'm not sure what my plan was, but I just felt like I was going to do fine. I can handle this. I can still manage this. I can still make it work. Because my whole life, I had always made it just work out. And what I thought, I thought I would make it work out. And that finally got talked into coming back to Visalia. So I did. I came back to Visalia 22 years ago. Well, 23 years ago, because it wasn't the new year yet. So in 1994, I came back. And I wasn't ready to give up drinking, but I was ready to use my mother. I was ready to use her home. I was ready to use the bed that she gave me. I was ready to use her shower and her laundry to keep my clothes clean. I was ready to do it. I'm a user for a babysitter because I hadn't quite lost my son yet, but I still had him. And I was ready to use her. And I did, as long as she would let me. And she let me use her for quite some time. And one of the stipulations about my mother was you can't drink at home. And I said, okay, so I didn't stay there very much because I had to drink, so I would leave my mother at home taking care of my son, and I would go drink and find those friends of mine in what I considered not bars and have them, and they would help me drink. And they would buy me drinks because I was always good at having people buy me drinks too. And that's how I continued my drinking for a little bit until I was almost 30 years old, and this is where it started to turn. My husband at the time, or my ex-husband at the time, had already come back here to California and said, you know what, until you figure out what's wrong with you, I'm going to take you to court for that son if you don't just turn him over to me. So go figure out what's going on with you. He took my son. So I had no son, and now I'm living at my mother's, and pretty much, and I'm getting ready to turn 30. And somebody said, you know how people say when you're getting ready to turn to one of those big milestones, especially if you're a woman, oh, don't worry about it. You've got lots of life left. It's only 30. You know, it's not a big deal. It's only 30. Most women go, oh, yeah, you're right. You know, I got a lot, lot, lot of life left. I'm good. Not me. When somebody said to me, you have a lot of life left, that's when the bottom inside of me dropped out. That scared the crap out of me. Because I was like, I don't think I can do this anymore. I don't really believe I can actually live this way inside the way I'm feeling and what I'm doing with my life anymore. So my best solution and my best idea that alcohol took me to was just to take my life. And then nobody would have to worry about me anymore, and I wouldn't have to worry about and feel this way. I was so tired of feeling the way I was feeling. And that didn't obviously work out, but it did land me in a mental institution, which, by the way, I also didn't know until I was about 10 years sober that I was actually in a mental institution. I mean, I realized I was in a mental institution, but you know that part of the book that says jails, institution, or death, that's what happens to all of us? You guys are so awesome because not one of you sat up there and corrected me every time I said, yeah, that none of that happened to me yet. And then my next sentence was, but then I came out of this mental institution. You know, and you guys were like, yeah, keep coming back, you know. You guys would let me say all these crazy things for the longest time. Well, still do. Thank you. And so I ended up in a mental institution. And you would think that would also be enough for me to come out of there kind of recognizing what's going on, but it wasn't. The best I could do was find some guy, you know. He may have been in an institution, not a bar, but I still had to find a guy. And out we came together. We're going to go live life now. Two crazy people. So we're sitting there having coffee because I don't know why I wasn't drinking. We were having coffee. And we're drinking this coffee, and I was giving him all my woes. We were having a self-pity party together. And so I was telling him that my mom wouldn't let me drink at the house, and she thought I had these drinking problems and all this other stuff. And he said, oh, no problem. I've got this card, and it's at this AA place, and I'll just take you, and they'll tell you. And I was like, oh, okay. And I thought I had to go with him because I thought it was like a gym card, you know, because I didn't know what AA was. So I thought it was like a membership card, and he had to take me here. So off we go on this card, and we go to the Alano Club. And by the way, he's not around. He didn't stick. He didn't stay. But he got me into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, which, by the way, I didn't think I belonged in, because you guys were a bunch of alkies, and you guys were going to just take one look at this 95-pound, hair falling out, gaunt, crazy, insane lady and say, you don't belong here. You're not one of us. You can go home. And I was going to get to go home and tell my mom, because that's where I lived, that I was not crazy. No, not that I'm not an alcoholic. And she's... So I walked in, and you guys do what you do, and you said, welcome, keep coming back, and then you wanted to hug me, and I was like, okay, yeah, no, that's not okay with me. None of that works for me, so I was pissed off because you guys didn't send me home, so I came back the next day, because that's who I am. I'll find that person, and I went and sat by somebody else, and they did the same thing, and pissed me off again. And I was thinking, because I wasn't drinking in your meeting, and I was drinking after your meeting, and I wasn't drinking in your meeting, you guys were pretty lucky, you know, that I was respecting you. I was here on a membership card, you know, by some guy I didn't know anymore, and I wasn't drinking in your meetings, and you guys just kept telling me to come back, and you wanted to hug me. And it just kept pissing me off. And I thought the Alana Club was like the only AA place in all of the whole world. I don't know. I just said that's the only place I went. And all of a sudden I figured it out. John Cody was the secretary, for those of you who know John Cody. He was the secretary, and he was up there at the table. And all of a sudden I was like, I figured it out. He's the person in charge of all you alkies. That's what it is. I've been introducing myself to the wrong freaking people. So I marched my way up to the front of the alcoholic, or to the, you know, in between all the alcoholics. You know, the people getting their card signed at the Alana Club, and they're all lined up. I'm like pushing by them, you know. I'm like, I got to get to this guy up there, the president of AA, and introduce myself so he knows. He can tell me I don't belong here. He's going to take one look at this good-looking girl and say, yeah, you go home. You're not insane. And so I go up there, and I introduce myself. I'm so proud of myself. He must have just looked at me and thought, what is wrong with this girl? And he just grinned and smiled and said, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Keep coming back. And I wanted to punch him. I was like, what is wrong with you people? That's when God did. That very same day, God finally had enough of me. And was like, okay, you're just dense, lady. So he, like, gave me my first God shot. And as I was walking out of the Alano, they had the literature up against the wall back then. And I was walking out, and I literally felt like my hand did something I didn't want it to do. It grabbed one of the literature things out of there. Now, there's another member in our club who talks about how he's here for information only. That's how he got here. I'm here for information only. He didn't want nothing to do with you guys. I was like, yeah, well, I'm not even here for your freaking information. I don't even want that. But for some reason, I'm picking up your information. So I kind of figure that's my first God shot. I go to my mother's home. That's where I'm living. I go back to my mom's home. And I put it down, and I'm looking at it, and I grabbed it, and what it was the test. Now, here's the second God shot. I actually answered the stupid things honestly. Those questions that they ask, for the first time, unbeknownst to me why, I answered those questions honestly. And I was really happy, because at first when I got it, I was like, perfect. I'm going to answer this. I'm going to pass. And I can prove to my family I'm not an alcoholic. So I answered them. I passed. And I started bawling. I was just devastated, because my perception of an alcoholic was exactly what I thought now I had to go do. I thought, now I have to go live on a bench, wear a trench coat, drink out of a brown paper bag, be homeless, because that's all I knew about alcoholics, you know? So I really was like, my life is over. And so I'm just crying hysterically. My mother, who has never really heard me cry that much before then, heard me from the other side of the house, comes running back into my room and says, what's the matter? So I hold up this test and I said, I'm an alcoholic. And she goes, I know. She's all happy. I'm crying, you know. I so wish I had a YouTube of that. And I could have been a millionaire, you know. So, you know, the best part about this is that God led me exactly where I needed to be when I needed to be there. Because once I found out I was an alcoholic, I knew where to go. I knew to come back to you guys. And I walked back into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, this time not trying to find that person to tell me that I didn't belong, but to try to find that person to tell me why I belonged here. I couldn't understand it. Because when I walked in, I still just felt like a really bad person. You know, that's all I conceived of myself, is that I was this bad person. And what I got to hear from a podium just like this at the club was, you're not a bad person, you're a sick person who needs to get well. And, you know that relief, that ease and comfort I got from my alcohol? When I heard that, for the first time in my life, I could breathe. I got that ease and comfort because you guys told me something that was completely opposite of what I believed about myself. And then you guys took me with all my wreckage, my baggage, all the yuckiness about me, and you just smiled, wanted to hug on me, love me, and told me to keep coming back. And I really didn't get that. I was just like, okay. And now I just felt like a little lost puppy. Because you know that little scared 11-year-old girl that took her first drink? Now I'm a big scared girl at the age of 30 in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, scared to death. Because I didn't know how to live life without the drink, but I also didn't know how to live life with the drink. And now I knew the drink was part of my problem. And I had to put that down so I could get well. The mental institution wasn't going to do it for me. The psychiatrists that were trying to help me weren't going to do it for me. The spiritual quest that I had gone on before for myself, that obviously didn't do it for me. But a bunch of alcoholics told me, you guys had an answer, you guys had a solution. It was just going to take a little effort and work on my part. And then what I heard too from the podium that also gave me a little bit of a relief was something that I couldn't believe. They said, you never have to drink again if you don't so choose to. And all I could remember was sitting in that apartment in Denver crying, drinking, and I'm thinking, I have a choice. I don't have to sit there and drink and cry anymore. And so I decided to keep coming back. And I kept coming back and listening to what you guys had to say. You told me to get a sponsor. So I said, okay, so I got a sponsor. You guys said, so work these steps with your sponsor. And I was like, okay, I'll work the steps with my sponsor. And I just kept doing that next indicated thing that you guys told me to do. Back then, there wasn't a whole lot of room for niceties. My sponsor was just like, this is what you got to do. And if you don't want to do it, go find somebody else because I don't do it any other way but this way. And it's out of the book. And this is what you got to do. And if I tell you to get naked and push a peanut across the highway, that's what you'll do if you want to stay sober. I'm like, okay, you know, because I was scared. I was like, okay, I'll do whatever you need me to do because I so desperately did not want to pick up a drink again. And more importantly, not only did I not want to pick up a drink again, I so desperately wanted to get well. Because that was the message that I heard, that I didn't have to feel the way I felt anymore. When I was in the mental institution before I came into the rooms, I can remember I kept telling the psychiatrist, and he kept looking at me like, okay, you know, it's pretty bad if a psychiatrist in the mental institution is looking at you like you're really crazy. You know, that's how crazy I must have been. Because I can remember him looking at me like going, okay, lady, you know, just stay here. So I kept trying to tell him, I feel this black hole right here in my stomach. And I literally could feel it. I was like, I could describe it to him. I get into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and what I heard from you guys was that I have a hole in my soul. And I was like, oh, another relief. I was like, oh, wow, that's what's wrong with me. And I've been trying to fill it up all these years. And by the time at the end of my drinking, nothing was filling it up. Nothing was working. And all I could feel was this black, black hole in my stomach. In Alcoholics Anonymous, what I've had the pleasure and opportunity of getting to do is getting the freedom of that black hole, getting the freedom of me having to blame all of you for me, all my problems and everything that I've ever done. And I've had the freedom to become this person that isn't a scared little girl anymore. First time in my life, and that didn't happen right away in Alcoholics Anonymous. It took a lot of time. I was scared for quite a few years in Alcoholics Anonymous, honestly. I wasn't scared that this wasn't going to work. I was scared about who was I going to become, especially when I got to the sixth and seventh step. You know, I can remember literally saying to my sponsor, if I get rid of all these character defects, who am I going to be? Because I had never been anybody else but those character defects that we had listed out. I'm like, that is me. And it scared me. And she said, okay, well, yeah, God's not going to actually come down and wipe you clean of that all in one setting. In fact, you're probably going to live with a lot of these for quite some time. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, I bought a coffee mug the other day for a grand sponsee, actually, for her one-year birthday. And on it, it says, warning, I've got character defects and I'm not afraid to use them. And I'm like, yeah, that's me. You know, sometimes I'm not afraid to use my character defects. That's my husband. You know, and he's more than willing to tell me, yeah, you know, those aren't so good in our house. And I'm like, okay. So, but at least I have an answer today. I have a solution today that I don't have to take those character defects out on other people anymore. I don't have to take me out on you. I don't have to live like a scared little girl anymore. I don't have to live with a black hole in my stomach anymore. And that's all my choice. That's how come I get to choose today to not drink. Because I get to choose today to participate in my own recovery. I get to choose today to live in my book of Alcoholics Anonymous and find that God. Because the purpose of this book is for me to find a power greater than myself. Because I didn't really actually know that I thought I was that powerful. I'm now today constantly reminding myself, oh yeah, that's right, Catherine, you're not that powerful. You know, because I used to think I had all this power. And I get to choose to live this way today. Which means, guess what? I don't have to drink. I don't have to go seeking out that ease and comfort anymore from a drink to give to me that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me through finding a God of my own understanding that gives it to me on a regular basis. But I have to choose every single day because it says I get a daily reprieve based on my spiritual condition. So I get to choose every day to build up my spiritual condition so that today, not only am I not a tornado through people's lives, I also don't have to pick up that first drink. You know, and for me, that's the miracle of this program, is that I don't pick up that first drink, which means that I'm not a complete tornado through your life like I used to be. And I have friends today. You know those friends that I said I couldn't keep before? You know, I'm looking out here, and I had women that rode up here with me. They took time out on a Sunday morning and drove up here with me, and some of them are my sponsors. I mean, I actually have people that want to listen to what I have to say today. I mean, that's crazy. You guys all showed up to hear me. That's like insane. I mean, who in there? I can remember a day nobody wanted to hear what I had to say. You guys came all the way here on a Sunday morning to hear what an alcoholic had to say. And all I have to say is that if I continue to do on a daily basis what I learned to do when I got here in the very first place, and if I continue to do it after 22 years, I stand a pretty good chance of going home today, not wrecking a marriage, not wrecking my family, not wrecking my car, and getting to go to sleep before midnight, because I don't stay up till midnight anymore. I get to go to sleep sober again. You know, I couldn't have asked for that from when I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. All I wanted to do is how to learn not to drink and to feel a little bit better. This is way more than I bargained for. Way more. And, you know, it took a little bit of time in Alcoholics Anonymous, though, to figure out the life part. The drinking part, when the obsession was lifted for me, that part became a little bit easier. Drinking is not even an option for me today. I mean, I don't even think about it. No matter what I walk through, I don't have to think about that the drink is going to be my solution anymore, like it used to be. Today, what I have to worry about is my living problem, my thinking problem. That can still be a problem, you know? But if I continue to do what I've learned to do in here, and I keep turning it over to a God, I keep learning how to apply these spiritual principles into my life, then that's less of a problem for me today. I would love to be able to sit up here and say that I have no problems left in my life, but I'm a human being, and I got to learn that here too. You know, just because I'm an alcoholic doesn't mean that I'm going to come in here, do all this work, and then I'm magically going to be this person that has no problems anymore. What I'm going to do is become that productive member of society again today, become an actual human being that can live a life today that's worth living, and that people aren't going to want to be kicking me out of the place anymore. And I think for me, one of the best, you know, things, when I was 11 years old, you know, I teased about earlier about how all I ever knew how to do was get a drink and find a guy to help, you know, get me that drink and to always be on my side. I always had to have a guy with me. One of the best experiences that I had to go through in Alcoholics Anonymous was I got married and divorced in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have to pick up a drink. And after that first marriage was over, I stayed away from the guy thing, and I learned how to be with me. And I stayed away from it from like 2000 till about 2010. Dating, dabbling here and there, but for the most part, pretty much stayed away from it. And what I got to give myself an opportunity to do for the very first time in my life was I got to learn, not only I found the God that first 5 years of my sobriety, but then I got to learn how to have a relationship with that God. Of my own understanding. I got to learn how to use that God in my life. Not the guy. The guy didn't have to be my God anymore. And when I got that relationship with my higher power the way I have it today, magically that gave me a relationship with myself. And I had never been comfortable enough in my own skin to have a relationship with myself. That was like mind-blowing. Mind-blowing. I could actually sit at home now today by myself and be totally okay. I don't even have to turn on the TV if I don't want to. for noise. You know, there was a time I had to have that background noise going on to be okay. Today, I'd rather sit and read a book in the quietness. You know, my husband and I sit a lot. He works out of our house. Some of you guys know him. You know, he's been around longer than me. And he works in the back of the house, and I can sit out there. We don't even hardly talk sometimes. You know, it's like so quiet in that house. I never thought that I would like love the day where I can just sit in the house and be peaceful and quiet. And I didn't need the chaos of the noise going around me in my head, in my life. You know, I had to quit learning to stir that pot to make things happen in my life and just be able to sit. You know, and that has been, you know, another one of those moments where I can breathe again and I can just go, oh, a lot of ease and comfort comes from that. Just being able to sit with myself and know that I'm going to be okay. So I get this thing that when I was 11 years old, all I wanted was relationships with other people, but yet I never knew how to do them. Today, I have a wonderful marriage. I've been married, we've been together for almost 7 years. Actually, next month will be 7 years. I've known him since 1995, so I got to, like, check him out for a few years before I decided to date him. And so we have this wonderful marriage. We have this wonderful life together. And you know what? Those aren't the promises of the program. You know, people get that confused. The promises of the program is not that I'm going to have a wonderful marriage and a wonderful life with somebody and a home and a car and a job or whatever. The promises are I'm going to intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle me. But because I know how to handle situations which used to baffle me means that I get to have a better relationship with people. Because guess what? I'm not like pissing them off all the time. Just some of the time. So I've done better there. And I get peace of mind. You know, those are the kinds of promises in my life that allow me to have better relationships with other people today. So I actually have friends that come and take out their time to come up here and hear me share today to support me. It's not like they've never heard my story. Shoot, my sponsees are tired of listening to me. But they still show up. You know, but it's because they love me. Isn't that crazy? You know, it's because they love me, they want to be around me, and it didn't used to be like that. You know, people used to, like, run from me. No, I wasn't that bad, but it wasn't bad enough. They didn't want to be around me. They were tired of me blaming my stuff on them, and I don't blame them. But I don't have to live like that today. And, you know, I was talking to my sponsor who came up with me, too, today, and we were talking about the dance, New Year's Eve dance coming up, and I said, are you going to go? Because I haven't been in a few years, and I was thinking about it. I should probably go, and it made me think about it just now that when I got here, remember I didn't go to bars, I went to like dance clubs and stuff, right? Okay, so the purpose in my mind at the time was I was going to these bars to dance, and I thought, you know, I'd get out there and I'd dance, and I thought I was like this massive great dancer. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I go to my first sober dance. I go out on the floor thinking I'm still drinking, and I go out there to dance, and I'm like, oh my God, I can't dance. I was like, what's going on? You know, talk about being embarrassed. So that was the first year. Today at 22 years, I don't care that I can't dance. You guys have seen me, and that's also cool too. You know, what you guys think of me is none of my business. And if you don't think I'm a solid gold dancer, that's okay. In my head, I'm a solid gold dancer. So that's all right. You know, I get to be okay with that today. And, you know, and there's more to Alcoholics Anonymous than just the meetings. If you're new in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to share this with you. Know that showing up to a meeting is important. The fellowship is a big part of our sobriety. But hear the part about that it's just part of our sobriety. I see a lot of people coming in here and just showing up to the meetings and socializing and hanging out. This is not what I thought it was when I first came in. This is not a club. This is not a membership club, you know. Great, keep coming, keep doing that, but don't sell yourself short. Give yourself a break. If you really want a life that is worth having to the extent that Alcoholics Anonymous can give to us, get yourself into the book. Do the steps. Work a program. You don't have to live a life where you're throwing books off the balcony at 2 years sober. Which, by the way, Hannah, thank you for opening up for me. And you did a fabulous job. I just love Hannah. And I'll tell you, one of the biggest, you know, I keep saying, this is the biggest part of being sober. This is the greatest part. You know, there's so many great parts. I can say it's the biggest. Another great part about working, being in Alcoholics Anonymous is I get to work with other people. You know, and the book tells me I can't transmit something I don't have. And that kind of pisses me off, too, because sometimes I just don't want to do the work anymore. I just don't want to do it, you know. But then I have all these women that I am so honored and blessed that I get to work with on a regular basis who actually want to be in the book, who actually want to do the steps, who actually want to do more than just showing up to a meeting. That means, guess what? I have to be back in my book. I have to be doing more than just showing up to meetings. Those girls do more for me than I've ever done for them. You know, they keep me sober. They keep me accountable. They keep me transparent. And they keep me sane on a regular basis. I would not know what I would do without the people in Alcoholics Anonymous being there to help me. And I love the people that are honest with me. You know, I have a lot of girls that I end up on their fourth step. They're totally honest with me. You pissed me off here as my sponsor. I'm like, okay, sorry. But you know what? I heard the speaker one time say, if your sponsors don't have a resentment against you every now and then, you're not doing your job as a sponsor. So I was like, I took that to heart. So I've ended up on a few sponsees resentment lists, which is okay. You know, we get to talk about it. We get to be honest with each other. You know, I love that part about this too, is I have honest relationships today. And I think that's what makes my relationships work. They're honest, and I take responsibility for my part in that relationship. And so there's more to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's more to being sober. If you don't get this message, get the message that there's more to being sober than just not drinking. There's a story in the book that I absolutely love, and it's about there's a tornado going through the town, this farm, and the mom and the pa go down in the basement, and when they get out, they open it up, and the pa's like, look, Ma, the storm's all over, and there's wreckage everywhere, you know? And that was me. Look, I quit my drinking, but there was wreckage all over my place. And I had to learn to clean up that wreckage, and I have to learn to keep it cleaned up, keep my side of the street clean. And I'll close with this, and I can't even see the clock, so I have no idea, but I'll go ahead and close with this, because I remember there was this girl that came in, and they kept telling her she was new, and all she could hear was trust God and clean house, trust God and clean house. So she'd go home, she'd pray, she'd clean her house. You know, she'd go, and she kept coming back into the meeting saying, okay, I'm praying and I'm cleaning my house, and we're all like, keep coming back. Okay, so she'd go home, she'd pray, she'd clean the house, and then all of a sudden, one day, it's kind of like me figuring out 10 years into my sobriety that I actually hung out at bars. She's like, oh, she had started her step work. She got it. You know, she's like, I don't have to clean my house so much anymore. At least not on a daily basis. So whatever your messages are there, you just keep coming back. You know, that's what I did. I just kept coming back, and I waited for that miracle to happen. And you know what? Just because I've been here for 22 years, the miracles are still happening. I can't just stop not coming, because I'm going to still miss that miracle. Those miracles happen to me on a regular basis. It was a miracle that I was paralyzed from the neck down. And it's not a miracle that I could walk today. What do you guys think the miracle is? I didn't pick up a drink. I didn't even want to. That wasn't even my... I mean, it never even crossed my mind to solve any of my problems by picking up a drink. That's the miracle. And the other part of the miracle was is that people in Alcoholics Anonymous surrounded me as much as I would allow them to during that time, and made sure that I got back into meetings and gave me rides. In fact, okay, I lied. I'm not closing yet. Okay. That's my girls. I do that a lot. I tend to lie a lot. In fact, I saw this real short story. Really, seriously, I can't see the clock. Do I have time to tell one more story? Okay. Do you guys want to do one more story? Okay, so I have this sponsee. She was brand new, and I was on my walker, okay, because I was literally paralyzed from the neck down. I was at my mom's house in a hospital bed, and I went from a wheelchair hospital bed, and I finally graduated up to the walker, and somebody actually said, you have to get back into meetings. I'm like, no, I can't. I'm on a walker. They're like, yeah, you can. I don't care. You're on a walker. I'll drive you. And I'm like, okay, fine. So we get in the car, and she drives me, and I'm so grateful for that person, because I don't know, I might still be on a walker in my house being in my self-pity potty again. So I go there, and this girl, this newcomer comes in, and she's sitting in the meeting, and she's like, I need some information. Would you mind having coffee with me? And I said, okay. So we go off to have coffee. No, we did not. I told her, I said, I don't drive. I'm on a walker. And she says, okay, well, I said, can you give me a ride? And she's like, okay. So she comes and she gets me. And so one of the ways that I got her to get to meetings was I told her, I said, okay, what are you doing tonight? And she goes, nothing. I said, well, why don't you take me to a meeting? I need a ride. And she's like, okay, this poor lady. You know, this old lady on a walker, she needs a ride to a meeting. I went home and called the person and said, you're not picking me up anymore. I got a newcomer. And they're like, okay. So none of my friends gave me rides for like 3 months. This poor girl was taking me everywhere. Bob remembers. I used to have her out at the central office. I made her drive me out to the central office. She wasn't working. What'd she have to do? I'm like, here, let's go to the central office, hang out with Bob, and buy all these books. You know, you need all these recovery books. And I did. I made her take me everywhere. And that's how I wobbled around. And she just kept feeling sorry for me. But you know what? That girl had 6 years of sobriety today, not because of that, but because she felt sorry for an old woman on a walker, but more importantly because she heard the message of hope. She heard a message of a solution like I got to hear. And I was just smart enough to make her drive me everywhere. That's all I did. So I love that we get to do those things here in Alcoholics Anonymous today. And I love that you guys showed up today. And I want to thank you, especially those people that came with me today, took your time out of your day to come hear me once again. You know, these people that... Albert, oh my God, you show up to me. I went down to Bakersfield to speak one time and he came down there. I mean, it's like he goes anywhere I speak. You've got to be tired of it by now. I just love to support the Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys will listen to me talk all the time. At home, my husband's like, you've got many words. You know, let's try to limit some of them. I told him today, I said, I don't know if I'm going to be able to talk the whole time. And he looked at me and goes, oh my God, Catherine. He goes, you've got many words. And I'm sure, I'm sure you will find the words. And I'm like, oh, okay, you're right. He goes, yeah. So then you come home and in your many words, you will tell me about it when you get home. I'm like, okay. Because here's the man, he's 27 years sober, and he's going through a medical condition, and he's on, and I love that we get to do this today. You know, he stayed home because he's not feeling well, and I've got all these people that know him that are asking me about him when I show up because they worry about him. We worry about each other. We talk about it. You know, we ask about each other. We follow up with each other. We don't let us, those who become part of the hack, herd, do not get to disappear. You know, if I'm in the herd, I can't tell you how many times when I just stopped and I wanted to isolate, you wouldn't leave me alone. And I'm so grateful for that. I wasn't at the time. I wanted to be left alone. But today I can tell you how grateful I am that you don't leave me alone. So all of you out there that know David, don't leave him alone. Seriously. You know, those who know David, don't leave him alone. We help each other, support each other to get through the things that we need to get through so that not only that we stay sober, but that we don't feel alone. We don't have to do any of this alone. And I appreciate that so much. And I thank Susan for getting in touch with me and asking me to come today to participate in my own recovery and share a message of hope. And hopefully somebody got a little bit out of what I had my many words on today. So thank you.